Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Howdy, y'all. Thank you so much for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm the host of these here festivities. Name's Lady P, no relation to Master P. And today, I'm joined by one very special guest, author and film historian Patrick McGilligan. Welcome back to FlixWise, Pat.
Thank you for having me back.
Listeners will recall that we had Pat on for our special episode on the release of Young Orson, Pat's biography, which focuses on the early adventures of stage and screen legend Orson Welles. I know I've also talked specifically on the show about Pat's biography on Fritz Lang, which is amazing, and everyone should go check that out. And he's written a whole host of other essential works, including one that pertains to today's topic. I'm referring to Pat's 1989 biography on renowned American auteur, Mr. Robert Altman. The book is called Robert Altman, Jumping Off the Cliff. And again, I am so pleased to have you on to talk about Altman, specifically about the number 73 film on the International Sight and Sound poll, Nashville.
Great. Yeah. Love talking about Nashville.
Indeed. Indeed. Our normal podcast structure usually mandates that I focus almost exclusively on one film at a time. But because there is only one Altman film on the Sight and Sound list, I thought we could break with tradition a bit and broaden our scope to encompass most of Robert Altman's career, or at least the main points through MASH, up to Nashville, or beyond. We can see how much time we have. Mm-hmm.
Is there only one on the list?
I believe so, as far as I know. I gave it a look-see, and there's
terrible.
No... I know, isn't that a shame?
Might change.
Yeah, I have a feeling. Why don't you talk about your relationship with Robert Altman? First of all, what was the first film of his you saw?
Well, I'm not sure I could say. It was probably something like California Split. Either California Split or McCabe and Mrs. Miller. I saw them both in Boston when I was working for the Boston Globe. I remember seeing McCabe and Mrs. Miller down in what used to be known as near the combat zone, the pornography zone, in some big theater opening weekend. I wasn't reviewing it. I was the second string critic, so I wasn't important enough to do such things. Feeling... Is something wrong with the sound? Is something wrong with the projection? And then gradually adjusting myself to thinking, wow, this is really, really unusual and mysterious and wonderful. And saw California Split. I guess it's later in time. I don't have the filmography in front of me. And Altman was coming through. It was a little bit before Altman was acclaimed, although, you know, really... He was pretty well known within the film industry and the TV industry, even before MASH. And then, of course, MASH made him very prominent. But it was before he had, let's say, his cult following and his great, avid cult following. And I phoned him up at a hotel or motel that he was staying at in Boston. It could have been in Cambridge, in fact, where he was staying. And he was very grumpy and grouchy. I think I woke him up and didn't care that I worked for the Boston Globe. And I, you know, all the time I did know him, he was first of all, he had that sort of dry Midwestern affect. He's from Kansas City. I'm from Madison, which doesn't quite count because it's a little bubble in the Midwest. But he actually was a very warm, pleasant guy, but he didn't show that side of himself very often. Mm-hmm. Instead, he was a kind of persnickety guy, argumentative guy. But I think I said, I'd like to interview you, and can I have breakfast with you? And I went over to his hotel and had breakfast. And that was the start of a long relationship that was off and on over the years. I'd be at the same place. I was on the set of Popeye. I was at his house in Malibu. A few other things. And I really you know, think of him as someone who should have many more films on Science Sounds list. To me, I write so many books about so many people and about some people like Hitchcock that people just adore, and people like Orson Welles, which they more than adore, they revere and worship. And believe me, each one of these subjects has, you know, tremendous followings. And people often say, you know, who is, you know, which is your favorite director? I don't like to answer that kind of question. But honestly, it would be among all the people that I've mentioned, Altman, because I'm a modernist. He's a modernist. I think he was a complete one of a kind, although he spawned some people in his wake, like Alan Rudolph, who are very, very good knockoffs. And I don't mean that pejoratively. Alan Rudolph had a really wonderful career. He inspired a lot of people who worked for him to go off and do their own thing in interesting ways, sometimes as performers, sometimes as writers, sometimes as directors. But his body of work is just amazing to me. And it's not a – when I started writing the book, he only had the body of work in the 70s to acclaim. I started working on the book in the mid-80s, and the 80s looked like a pretty sparse period at the time. Although I look back on the 80s and I see some of those films really as remarkable and tough to watch, maybe, like Secret Honor, his one-person Nixon film, which I think is just an amazingly good film. Very, very good as theater and film, but also really, really good as politics and information and performance, everything. So he was kind of, he looked like he was on his way out in the 80s because he kind of retreated and did small theater projects filmed and a few other things. And so I did it before his big comeback, but he has a third act and then he comes along, you know, with films like The Player and Gosford Park and Shortcuts and a lot of very, very sharp and interesting films in between those, you know, all the way up until his last film, Prairie Home Companion. That is a long run. Mm-hmm. That is a long run of, I would say, magnificence, you know, not excellence. So my affection for his work and for a film like Nashville, for example, which I end up showing to one of my film classes, you know, every several years and therefore rewatch on a big screen. I don't think I've ever seen it on a small screen. I don't watch things on small screens unless I'm forced to at the point of a gun. It not only stands up, for me, it's the great film of the 70s. When people say The Godfather, I kind of shrug. You know, when they say Raging Bull, I say, well, that was 1980. That's how I get out of that argument.
Sure.
But there are a lot of great films made in the 70s, and including a lot of great films made by Altman in the 70s, two or three which would qualify as great, which is a lot, you know. But to me, Nashville is, like its director, one of a kind. It set the pattern for a lot of what he would do and a lot of that he had been trying to do with multi-character, overlapping sound, original soundtrack created by the people in the film, a community making the film with this kind of benign despot in charge, and a tremendous, tremendous political statement at the time of the bicentennial. I find the film amazingly entertaining, scene by scene, but it's also a tremendous bicentennial political statement. I think you could see the film today and see in Hail Philip Walker, you know, the precursor of Trump.
Sure.
And Altman was thinking that way. Not just then, but always in private. From my very first meeting with him, he didn't like it if you sat around and talked about film. And he didn't like it if you sat around and talked about his films. And he didn't like it if you sat around and praised his films. I mean, he would be talking about Watson and Crick and you know, who won the Nobel Prize in medicine in 1947. And his mind just pinged all around. He was a very, very, I wouldn't say intellectual because that, but he's a very cerebral man, a big reader, a deep thinker, And I find that film to be big and deep. And I don't find any other American film to be quite in its caliber. Although I did vote for Annie Hall as one of my
top
10.
Still an American film.
Because I like Annie Hall quite a bit too.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't claim that Annie Hall is big and deep except within the oeuvre of Woody Allen's work.
Sure.
It might not have something to say to everybody. And neither does Nashville, really, because Nashville, you have to go in for it and relate to it, or you're not going to like it.
Yeah.
And so you can't talk people into liking it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you mentioned the 80s, and that is supposedly kind of a fallow period of his career. But even still, there are still a few gems. And I know you talked about, you know, Popeye. And are there any other supposedly less than stellar works that you would like to mount a case for?
Well, Popeye. I was on the set of Popeye, and I know what a struggle it was for everybody to make that film. And partly because it was just an odd fit. And Altman was determined not to make a Disney, you know, family-friendly musical that would go through the roof at the box office. And everybody indulged him. I kind of liked the film, and I certainly liked the people, but it's kind of a bosh. You know, you can talk some people, you can show Nashville and make some people like it by showing it to them, but I'm not sure that's true of Popeye. It's probably not true of Quintet. It's undoubtedly not true of O.C. and Stiggs, you know, which comes at the end of the 80s or towards the end of the 80s. It's also a comedy, but an unfunny comedy. But by the way, Altman would, you know, if you said to him, he didn't like to sit around and be praised, but if you told him you didn't like Quintet, he'd tell you it was his favorite film. And then he watched it as often as he could, and he loved it. And, you know, he was very, very loyal to his films. And he would talk about them in such a way that it would make me, I laugh to say this because it probably would never happen, want to go back and see Quintet. What did I miss?
Right.
So he was very, very loyal, because for him it wasn't just the film. It was the experience of making the film, the people involved, and he was very, very loyal to that. If you said to him, what are your favorite films? He would say, I don't have favorite films and I don't have favorite children. You know, they're all my children and they're all my favorites. And he was very sincere about that. I don't think it was a feint or anything. Undoubtedly, he knew which ones were greater in the sense that they got Oscar nominations and did tremendously well at the box office and are still getting votes from Sight and Sound people.
Sure.
And we know which ones those are, you know. But to a certain extent, he'd then react against that success. You know, he'd shrug off MASH, which I also show every several years and think is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And I think the entire 70s, it doesn't get to, the clinkers don't start to come until maybe about Quintet, because I think A Wedding is just great fun.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen Health in many years, and I would love to see it. I bet it's really fun. I love the movie A Perfect Couple, which is about a communal rock and roll band and some ugly ducklings who are romancing each other in the course of the story. And it also has tremendous charm and invention. And all these films I'm mentioning have remarkable soundtracks, you know, that are usually done by people that are connected to the movie, usually on the screen. So they have all these Altman touches that nobody else was doing, and partly because he was working almost completely outside the studio system. He would get studio distribution, he would get studio financing, but he had a mentality of screw the studios. Very, very angry man about Hollywood and the studio system, and he didn't care to give the studios what they wanted. He wanted to make the anti-movie, you know, the movie. He would say, and he'd be very articulate about this, that he didn't care about, you know, big box office. He cared about quality box office, you know, bringing in people of quality to see his films. And honestly, I don't, you know, when sometimes he would say, I'm making the film for the fun of it, and I don't care if people come or not. And honestly, that was partly true, too. He really had enormous fun, creative fun doing it, loved his own work, and was very happy if it was embraced, was sour if it was not. But he never looked over his shoulder and said, well, you know, I'm going to slow down. People didn't like the last three movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't stop to reevaluate his approach or anything. He just held steadfast.
Yeah.
Like,
and
what tremendous
yeah. variety, too. Yeah. I mean, what genre would you put Nashville in?
It's a great question.
So because he's completely an anti-genre person, so that when he makes a genre up until Gosford Park, I should say, but I don't know what Gosford Park genre. That's the BBC genre,
sure, yeah.
But and still done very adroitly. But he would make McCabe and Mrs. Miller, so that was like an anti-Western,
yeah.
And which, you know, the idiot gets shot at the end and buried under snow, and his, you know, lovelorn prostitute girlfriend is doing opium in the Chinese den. This is not a traditional Western solution.
Yeah.
And he would take a beautiful, beautiful set like McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and he would shoot it in that marvelously cluttered, obscured way. I remember being on the set of Popeye, which was the most gorgeous, wonderful set I'd ever been on, except maybe Coppola's One from the Heart. And I'm saying designed, created, built set as opposed to a real-life landscape, and you hardly see it in the movie. I mean, he's perverse about it, you know.
Yeah.
I think to the detriment of Popeye, but it really, really works in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. In Nashville, he's out in real life and with people creating this sort of complete, you know, you'd have to say crazy quilt or patchwork quilt of America that is making a statement about America, but also with all these people interacting, et cetera. Who else would do that? And what do you call it? Do you call it a drama, a comedy, a musical?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You can't call it. It's just one of a kind.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing.
I think that's why it's hard for audiences, especially unprepared audiences and especially young audiences, to appreciate someone like Altman or, let's say, Cassavetes, you know, to enlarge the picture slightly, that we're trained, nurtured, coached, and bought, you know, to see genre pictures, to see remakes, sequels, franchise hits, and things that in various ways we've seen before in other guises. And this creates within us a familiarity and a comfort zone, and we respond warmly when we see the crime story or the Western or the, it used to be the romantic comedy before they went extinct,
right.
but various genres. He doesn't play those games. He's always doing something, you know, that forces his audience to meet him halfway, going in a different direction.
Definitely, yeah. Since you have the biographical background, I thought maybe we could kind of talk about the evolution of the Altman style, particularly starting with maybe his work at the Calvin Company and the television work. Maybe start at the beginning.
Yeah. Now, almost all of this was relatively unknown when I started my book in the early to mid 1980s. And I got on a train and went down to Kansas City looking for the Calvin films and looking for the Calvin people. And in fact, went to a warehouse with a guy who had just bought it all up as stock, taking it all back to New York, and got some stuff out of cans. And people handed me films in cans. And, you know, Bob had gone to a prep school. He was Catholic, but he's obviously a very, very, you know, let's say subversive Catholic, if he was a Catholic at all after school. And then he went into the Army, which really informed a lot of his views of lots of different war films and war-related kinds of projects, including combat on television, which he was very instrumental in helping to create and create the visual style of it. After the war, he went to Hollywood and knocked around and tried to write scripts and get parts. And you can see him in little in the background of like a Danny Kaye movie. And he does have a couple script credits with a guy that he hooked up with who he stays, as Bob does, loyal to for a couple decades. And then that guy turns up back in Bob's career later on. Anyway, he couldn't really catch a wave in Hollywood. He had no connections, which I think is really something I relate to about him. He was from the Midwest. He had no L.A. or New York connections. He had no big organizational newspaper connections. So he went back to Kansas City. The only job he could get, the only related job he could get, was making what used to be called industrial films for a big, big company called the Calvin Company. And they were big because they made industrial films for corporations and organizations all around America. But things also like for the Boy Scouts and for, Chamber of Commerce. And Bob made, one of the things he made were those kinds of driver safety films that you used to see in high school where they show car crashes and then you say, don't drive like that or you'll be dead. Don't do this when you're on the road. And I think certainly that inspired a lot of car crashes in Bob's films, including that really fantastic one in Nashville where he finally got it out of his system or got a lot of it out of his system. But he really... he did a lot of films for organizations that were very, very conservative in format, conservative in style, very, very scripted, ABC filmmaking. And that's how he learned to film. People say that even then he was a wild man. He was a partier. He liked to imbibe. And he liked to do things that weren't in the script. He hooked up with some people, during that period of time that he came back to later in his career, and you see them in his film, whether it's, the Considines or the Wynns, the Wynn family, and many people, I should say, including other people who worked on Calvin films and followed him out to Hollywood. His cameraman and editor followed him out to Hollywood and became very, very successful and great. Cameramen and editors. So they were doing very, very, making a living. It was driving Bob crazy. So he was also doing a little theater. He was doing little film projects. Like he tried to get a TV series going with Eileen Ford Models, sort of, presages prêt-à-porter, but this is also not a great film. But and he did various film projects, various TV projects. He made one movie that he wrote, which totally presages Nashville. It's a country and western musical starring Jimmy Dean, and called Corn's a Poppin'. And it was only shown in Midwestern theaters in the chain of the theaters of the guy who bankrolled the picture. And I've seen it. I have a copy of it. It's quite terrible in many ways and quite fascinating in others. But it just shows how active Bob was, how much he was doing, how his mind was constantly going and in creative directions. By the way, all music, done for the film. So as many ways contains the ingredients of what came along afterwards. And several times he quit or was fired by the Calvin Company, all of whom remembered him really, really fondly. And his boss was a guy by the name of Frank Barhyte. And Frank Barhyte Jr., decades later, ends up as the co-screenwriter of Shortcuts and other Altman films. So this is a guy with tremendous continuity in his life, personal and professional. However, he finally leaves Kansas City because he just can't stand it anymore. And there's no way for him to progress. And gets in a car with his buddies, and they drive out to California in about 54 or 55. I'm not sure really exactly without reading my own book. And starts getting jobs in Hollywood, including he works for Alfred Hitchcock on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, gets fired there, makes the first documentary about James Dean not long after, a very short time after James Dean died, with Stuart Stern, who had written Rebel Without a Cause, a very, very good film, shockingly good considering its pinch-penny budget and the fact that they would invent scenes and dramatize scenes. It's a documentary, but they create some drama within the documentary. Very, very good first Hollywood film. And I'm leaving out much that he did because he did other things in Kansas City. And then he starts having a career because he got fired by Alfred Hitchcock, or probably by Joan Harrison, for not following the script, or for saying the script is crappy, can I do something to make it better, which is a classic. By the way, it should probably be written on his tombstone. He starts working in syndicated TV with a lot of people that later turn up in all of his movies, people who weren't A-list, and doing very, very interesting series. This brings him back to big television, network, Bonanza, fired, Combat, fired. absolutely essential to the look and style and design of those programs. And he would get bored. You know, I mean, he would do enough of those episodes that he would get bored. He worked on many, many such series. And finally ends up, nobody in Hollywood will hire him for a variety of, it is a variety of reasons, by the way. It's not always just that he tells them to go to hell. Sometimes he's sneaking around doing what he promised he wouldn't do. He's giving interviews attacking the union's grip on Hollywood because he wants to hire young people, you know, in the trades, giving such interviews. So he gets a black name, and he starts doing, for the mid-60s, he starts doing things like commercials, second unit on features, his own little mini-movies for parties, to show at parties, which are quite extraordinary, and music videos, the first music videos. I think they were supposed to go into, what are those things that you push buttons at the bar and it plays music? It was,
jukebox.
Yeah, it was going to be a form of jukebox, you know. And he does a lot of very interesting things while he's meanwhile writing very important scripts with a variety of people, trying to get some studio to take him back. And Jack Warner brings him back to make Countdown, which was someone else's script. It's one of the first films about astronauts. And he turns it into a real Altman movie. It has limitations. It may not be great. They took it away from him and recut parts of it, including the ending, so it wasn't so bleak, a la McCabe and Mrs. Miller. But it has a lot of the sort of party atmosphere, communal atmosphere in the acting, the really biting commentary on American society. Extraordinary film. And that brought him back so that he was doing television films. And then he got offered this, you know, this loser of a project, MASH, and a backlot, the Fox backlot to shoot it in while they were also making, I think it's Hello Dolly and Tora, Tora, Tora. So no one was paying any attention to him.
Sure.
Or what was going on in that movie.
Yeah.
And that established him.
Right. And the rest is history. So in this early period, do we start to notice more of the formal aspects that would come to define his career? And I suppose we should probably talk about what those formal qualities are.
Yes, you really begin to notice it in syndicated television in the late 1950s. Shows like The Whirlybirds, which is in the archives here in Madison, Wisconsin, and so I got to watch them all. They're sometimes quite interesting visually. The stories quite interesting sometimes. Bob was, of course, always involved in script, even when his name wasn't on it. And then you really see it in things like Combat. I mean, there's an episode of Combat, I forget what the title of it is, which has, I think, almost no dialogue, because Vic Morrow is wandering around in a bombed-out daze. And it's extremely adventurous for television. And so you begin to see the sort of painterly visuals of Altman, the constantly moving camera. And I don't mean moving on a track, but I mean moving, panning, slow zoom, the constantly moving performer with the camera following the performer. I know someone who used to work for Antonioni who says there are two ways to make a movie. The camera follows the actor, or the actor follows the camera. Bob had the camera follow the actor, and you begin to see that on television. The overlapping dialogue and the dialogue that's inconsequential. So sometimes it's overlapping and you wish you heard what they said. And other times it's inconsequential. Like we want to know a lot of what McCabe said in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And you have to watch the film maybe more than once to find out. And that's partly because Warren Beatty is doing a hell of a job. It's also because that's Bob's style, you know, which is to withhold some things from the viewer, withhold some things that they would normally be comfortable with, that sharp, crisp sound, which is almost always like redubbed in the studio. I mean, I was watching Gone with the Wind the other day and watching Eddie Rochester Anderson's scenes, and, you know, his mouth would move and then the words would come out differently, even though it was his voice, because they're just doing it all over. And Bob hated doing that. That's why he had so many microphones around eventually. So he would just have everything mic'd, and then he would just play with the mics there. He didn't want to have the actors come back in and act, because all the magic of the acting was taking place in front of him, and he loved that. So you see the joy in the performers, which is part of his style. You begin to see, you know, especially with MASH, you know, you see the soundtrack going crazy, including, I mean the sound effects, the sound editing, and the music, because, you know, Suicide is Painless is written by his, I think, 14-year-old son or something.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Nuts.
Yeah. And the song was recorded by many people afterwards.
Yeah.
So you begin to see, yes, by MASH, you know, he's a great example of a guy who arrives outside of Hollywood to the public eye pretty fully formed. I mean, by the time of MASH, he's in his 40s. So he's not a guy from the 60s, even though he had many values from the 60s and he was very attuned to the 60s. He was a guy in middle age. He was fully formed, and he was fully formed by telling Hollywood to go get screwed and them telling him back, you're out of a job, over and over again, and not softening his creative approach. So have I missed a visual, a stylistic element of his?
I think that's generally what he's most known for. Yeah, and I guess
multiple cameras, multiple moving cameras. He loved to have a lot of options in the editing room, even though he himself usually knew exactly what he was going to use when he shot it. You know, he would have other options, giving the performers a lot of room to improvise. The performers, especially who were capable of it. Driving the writers often crazy and angry crazy. But often, and sometimes that failed miserably, but often it got amazing results. Yeah. That the scene would be set up and he would walk in and they would talk it over, and then the performers would go to work and you'd get something really wonderful spinning off the page. So most of those things that we think of as Bob fully formed, were fully formed by the time of MASH, which is one of the reasons why the run of films, you know, right after MASH, you know, Brewster McCloud, Images, you know, leading up to Thieves Like Us, California Split, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and I'm probably missing one in between, are so striking. They're not all great. Like Images has its problems. Brewster McCloud has its problems. But each of them are really, really very, very exciting and interesting on their own. And each is so different from the one before. He really, really was ready to go. Jack Nicholson's another good example. By the time you see Jack Nicholson in Easy Rider in 1969, he's been around a long time. He's a really smart guy. He knows how to shoot the film. He knows how to write the film. He knows how to edit the film. And best of all, he knows how to act the film. So the next 5 years or 10 years of Nicholson's career are amazing, because he had it all planned out in his mind, who he wanted to work with and the kinds of things he wanted to do. Bob had been itching for someone to shoot the starter pistol and say, go ahead, Bob, do whatever you want to do. And he, you know, MASH made so much money that it gave him a ticket to ride for a decade.
Yeah.
And some of the films over that decade also made a lot of money, so he kept getting another ticket to ride up until really Popeye and Quintet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about his techniques, his directorial style as it pertains to acting. You talk about how you make it sound kind of like he could be a little bit curmudgeon-y. And yet he seemed to really be able to foster a great rapport with this kind of stock of actors. Can you talk more about
I don't think he was, you know what, he was curmudgeonly with me or persnickety with me because I was a journalist and a writer from the outside. I think that's me and my profession and his relationship psychologically with that profession. He didn't carry on wars with critics. He had no reason to, for the most part. Intelligent critics adored him. But he wasn't interested in their probing and in their profiles. He wasn't interested in glamour and success in the typical Hollywood way at all. And he didn't have that. He had the opposite relationship with actors. I've never met an actor who didn't love him for the love he gave to them. He gave them only approval. He was wonderful at casting. He would know somebody. By the way, he could cast somebody, you know, walking through a room who wasn't a professional, but somebody who was a professional who had an ability to act, you know, somebody like Paul Newman. I think Paul Newman is wonderful in Buffalo Bill and the Indians. He doesn't have as good a chance in Quintet, but, you know, he was able to take big stars as well as non-stars and really get marvelous performances out of them because he gave them approval. He said, sure, sure. And then he would, you know, I've seen Bob in a bad mood, but I haven't seen Bob in a bad mood on the set because of the actors. He's always laughing, you know, just holding back his pleasure because of sound, you know, watching them act. It's one thing he couldn't do, even though you see him in some Calvin films, you know, making little cameos. It's one thing he couldn't do. He respected it. He loved actors. And so as we know, discovered wonderful people who had very limited careers, mostly under his purview, but people like Shelley Duvall is probably the best example. But he loved actors, and he really had a great eye for casting. And, I mean, if you look at Nashville, I mean, I was just watching Gone with the Wind, as I mentioned, and, you know, Leslie Howard struggles with a bad part, which is a weak character. Mm-hmm. You don't see that in Nashville. Who has the bad part? Who is the weak character? You see all these people, some people who we know very well, partly from other Altman films, but, you know, people like Lily Tomlin, Ronnie Blakely, Henry Gibson, Keith Carradine. Have these people ever had better parts? I'm sure they have, because they're really, really good people and they're good actors. But these were parts lovingly crafted for them and fit them like a glove. And then Bob said, do more with it, have fun with it, you know. And I don't, you know, Michael Murphy, who we love, is that his name, the actor?
Who does he play?
The Hal Philip Walker lead man.
Oh, okay. Yep.
He's also in Woody Allen movies.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's where, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a wonderful actor always. That role fits him like a glove. I mean, they're just, Barbara Harris never did very much in film. Yeah. You see her in Family Plot, Hitchcock's last film. He really tried to give her a good part. She has a lot of screen time. She just never comes alive. Oh, she is quite wonderful in Nashville. All the people, including, you know, right down to the assassin, you know, are very, very captivating. They are given, they are not rushed. They are given time to, you know, Altman liked to say to behave, you know, not to perform, to behave like the character. And they are given time to behave. And, partly that's the fun of the film, is watching these people work it out, you know, work out their performances and what they're doing on the screen. And I think that that's a remarkable aspect of his talent, which is unsung. You know, Woody Allen is a great caster, and he gets anybody to work for him. But you see sometimes when he has an ensemble film of how some people are just go on and off stage, and they don't really have much to do. And he wanted them there because he admired them, but he didn't write something very good for them to do. That doesn't happen the same way in Altman's film. Another good example would be A Wedding, which is arguably not a great film, but it has amazing stuff for John Cromwell to do or for Lillian Gish to do. And, you know, sort of the apex of that, of going in the opposite direction, not the big cast, but the little cast, three women. Is it a great film? I don't know.
Is it? I think it's a great film.
Yeah. Well, I would say it's inarguably a near great film. And then whether it's a great film depends upon, maybe your taste for that kind of thing. But how do you define that kind of a thing? It's a dream movie.
Yeah.
And it has maybe seven people in it that matter to the story, none of whom is a big star, although Sissy Spacek was kind of a big star at the time, and all of whom are just remarkably good in every scene in front of the camera. Long Goodbye, was Sterling Hayden ever better? I don't know. Mm-hmm. He's pretty darn good in that.
Yeah.
So Bob really had a good eye for talent. He had respected talent. He admired talent. And I never met an actor who didn't love him because he only gave them love. He didn't say bad things about actors.
Yeah. So let's talk about Keith Carradine in Nashville.
Yeah.
Because the way that he used him, both in terms of his songwriting abilities and his acting talent, kind of makes the film in
yeah.
some regard.
Yeah.
So maybe we can tell the story of how Altman heard the two songs that would become the centerpieces of Nashville.
You might have to tell the story, not me. Did you read it somewhere recently?
In the Criterion Collection, they offer this is according to Keith Carradine, so this is his side of the story.
Yeah.
Was that
well,
he,
I would believe Keith Carradine.
Okay.
Yeah.
That Altman heard, he was playing his guitar at some party, I think, and was playing these songs, and that, I guess, inspired the idea to have the performers write their own songs and perform them for the movie.
Well, I'm sure that's true. And he had Ronnie Blakely. He had people who could. He had Karen Black.
Right.
Was Karen Black ever better? I mean, she's quite marvelous in the film too.
Yeah.
And did we know she was a country and western singer?
What?
I believe that story. I mean, you have to remember that Keith Carradine. He comes up in he's in McCabe and Mrs. Miller,
right.
Unforgettably. I believe that's his first Altman film. Mm. I'd have to go back and check. But he's that very innocent, nice guy, cowpoke, who gets blasted off into the ice dead, you know, by that rotten villain character who's so good, that actor. I don't even know where he ever went, and dies. And then he comes along in Thieves Like Us, and he holds the screen, and that is a mini gem of a movie. So he was deep into the Altman camp, and a kindred soul. And so he ends up, what's wonderful about it is I think, you know, he's playing this absolutely, in most ways, despicable guy.
Absolutely.
Which I think is not the real Keith Carradine. So you really see great acting and his best songwriting. I think it won best song.
I'm easy.
And he has a couple numbers. They're just wonderful. Yeah, it's hard to say like who is the focus of the movie, but certainly he's one focus.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, very impressive. All of the performers, like, the songs are real standouts, and they really hold up.
Do you know that Keith Carradine, I mean, not only did he go on to have really a really sterling career, and he's on television now. I think he's on Madam Secretary or on something.
Oh.
But he actually is the star with Sandra Locke of a new Alan Rudolph film, the first Alan Rudolph film in like 10 years that's been sitting on the shelf waiting for release.
Really?
Yeah, so that's, again, more continuity because he starts with Altman. Rudolph starts with Altman.
Right.
Here we are. We're going to have, you know, however many years it is after Bob's death, another Altman film in the form of an Alan Rudolph film starring Keith Carradine. And Keith Carradine did star in several very well-known early Alan Rudolph films.
So Alan Rudolph was the first AD?
He was the first AD, but he was always like a guy, you know, first ADs can do lots of things, you know, a variety of things depending on what their talents are. He was shooting Second Unit. He was shooting some scenes with actors. He was doing some writing rewriting, although it's Joan Tewksbury's script.
Sure, yeah.
Ooh, everybody's doing a little writing.
Sure, yeah. And let's talk about Joan Tewksbury. I mean, that's also another part of how this story began, right? He Altman sent her down to Nashville to come up with a story.
Yeah, I think Joan Tewksbury is again also starts on McCabe and Mrs. Miller. They're all young, younger than Bob, you know, by 20 years probably, and I think she's like the script supervisor on, you know, a smart script supervisor eventually becomes like, you know, in charge of everything. And doing a little writing, she has a scene, I think, and then she worked on Thieves Like Us, and then, she said, Bob said, I have an idea, what do you think, and sent her down to do some research, and had she written a script before, she might have written another script that didn't get made, but anyway, and
she wrote something about her divorce, I think.
Was that later? Old Boyfriends? Is that what it is?
Was that later?
I don't know.
Okay.
Anyway, I always have to reread all my books before I do a very detailed interview. But I can tell you that Joan was that is the great script. You know, look, every great film has to have a great script or forget the argument, you know. Then you're just saying, oh, you love the film because you love John Wayne or something. It has to have a great script. That was a great script. And then everybody pitched in and did their best to make it better in various ways. But Joan was young. It was her first script. She later on directed, and she did a few other films. And she had a falling out with Bob. I think just because Bob has fallings out with writers, always did, usually made it up to them and brought them back. I think Joan Tewksbury is in, she might be in The Player. She's in some movie where she comes,
where she comes back
and has a cameo, because Bob, he's not a venal or vengeful or vindictive personality at all. And once he likes you, he likes you forever. And, I think he went back and made it up to her. I don't know what it was, but, you know, sometimes Bob would get done with the film and talk about it in interviews and things as if he did everything. Other times he wouldn't, but sometimes he would. And sometimes the writers didn't get enough credit. And sometimes Bob shared the credit. And it's very hard to sort out in some circumstances who, you know, but these are people who know each other well and have hurt feelings for their own reasons before credits come along. But anyway, she really deserves, you know, more recognition than she's gotten.
Yeah.
And he worked with female screenwriters quite a bit, because he also worked with Vic Morrow's ex-wife, Barbara Turner. He worked with her on the script that became Petulia before it was pieced off to Richard Lester. And then he worked with her on the ballet film that was made towards the end of his career.
Company?
Yeah, The Company. Yeah. She's the mother of Jennifer Jason Leigh, who is Vic Morrow's daughter.
Oh,
yeah. And they have a very, very close long-term connection dating back to Vic Morrow, who had, you know, as you know, a tragic death. But he also had a very unhappy marriage, and his wife was Barbara Turner. Goes all the way back to the 60s. Really, almost everybody Bob ever worked with, they either went back to the 60s or the late 50s, either to Kansas City or to that group in Hollywood that was kicking around and wanted to do things independent of the studios and wanted to do things differently. Or later on, it was their children.
Yeah. It's a long lineage, I guess. It's a legacy.
That's not true in anybody else's case that I know of. Mm. You know, when we talk about other, you know, let's say we're talking about the great directors of today, and let's say we thought it was Quentin Tarantino, Spike Lee, Steven Spielberg. You can say anybody you want. It's fine with me. It's just not as true. It's not as true. They're not. Making films with the same people they made films with 40 years ago.
Sure.
in different iterations. Scorsese, to a certain extent,
yeah.
Behind the scenes,
yeah.
You know, behind the camera, and yeah, to a certain extent.
Yeah, he might be the other exception.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think there's something to loyalty. I mean, there's a reason Scorsese keeps making good movies, and there's a reason Altman kept making good movies.
Yeah, and you know what? He wasn't restless. He liked his group.
Yeah.
You know, he liked his group of he got new people as he went along, and he got old people as he went along, but he liked his little niche. You know, he wasn't trying to become He wasn't trying to win an Oscar.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of people he worked with, I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention Jim Webb, who sort of pioneered the recording technique that was used on Nashville.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And Richard Portman and other people who came along. You know what? If you look at his cameraman, the cameraman, and then you look at the cameraman's credits, sometimes the camera credits for the people are very undistinguished. People did their best work with Bob because he gave them a lot of rein, and he demanded a lot. He was always very, very, you know, we haven't something that isn't mentioned very often in terms of Bob's films is production design, but he was very, very, he had a painterly eye and a painterly interest in production design. So whether it's the color or the set or the kind of camera work that he's getting in a particular film, some of them so striking, you know, I mentioned Three Women, some of them so very specifically oriented in terms of what colors they are and the effect that he's going for. That came first from Bob, you know, and then it came through the production designer, through the camera person. The sound people, again, if you look at their credits, they will have hundreds of credits, many less distinguished. The idea for sound and the idea for doing that with sound came out of Bob and his experience with Calvin Company, where every stupid word in the script had to be said crisply so that the client heard it, and that was what the film was about. Bob didn't think the film was about what the actors say. He thought it was about this painting that involves the actors doing things, the colors, the light, the music. He saw it as something bigger than just, you know, the words on the page. One of the reasons why he butted heads with so many writers who write and fall in love with their words on the page. But you could do a lot worse than to hand your script to Bob.
Sure. Yeah, you're very likely to get a pretty good movie out of it.
Yeah, and mostly he's pretty deeply involved in the writing while it's going along.
Yeah, yeah. One kind of unsung aspect of the movie is the costuming design, which I actually think is brilliant. everything everyone wears is so specific to the character. And I wondered if
Jeff Goldblum.
Oh my God! Yes.
or Shelley Duvall.
Or Shelley Duvall.
Yeah. Or the guy who's the assassin. You know, because I shouldn't say that and spoil in case someone hasn't seen the movie.
Sure.
But he's not really an assassin. He's a troubled person. But even his outfit. I mean, even his clothes. Yes. Who is the clothing design? You would have to tell me. Is it Scotty Bushnell?
I'm not sure. Is it? Should look this up.
Yeah. It's. Yes, the clothes, you know, make the people.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if in a lot of those cases they talked to the actors and heard their ideas for what they should wear.
Yeah, that was my guess watching it.
Yeah.
Was that the actors must have had some input on what they were wearing
because
everything is so tailored to each individual character.
Yeah, see, I think that's different than, again, you know, not to say anything against Scorsese, but that kind of communal back and forth isn't happening on those kind of movies.
Sure. Yeah.
It just isn't happening.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're making a movie like The Departed, where there's so much invested and there's so much money going to stars, there's a lot happening with production design, wardrobe, costume that's being pieced off to geniuses, you know, who are just doing things according to plan. It's flowing in a different way in an Altman film, and he really is listening and talking to everybody and trying to come up with something that pleases them as well as himself first, but he's pleased when they're pleased.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's probably a good place to leave this, but before we wrap things up, I have to ask the obligatory question about the Sight and Sound ranking.
Yeah.
This is number 73.
Yeah.
I think I can guess what your thoughts are about that placement.
Well, I've voted in that poll, and I voted for Nashville
okay.
in my among my 10, and without hesitation. I had hesitation about some of my votes, and I'm a little surprised. But, you know, I would say in its defense that I happen to love Jacques Tati, but the American who loves Jacques Tati is someone who's worked hard to get there. I'm not sure you can get Nashville everywhere in the world. Mm. See, Hitchcock, he perfected Clint Eastwood too. So, I mean, on different kinds of people for different folks. Hitchcock perfected the kind of film that could go around the world and be seen by all kinds of audiences and achieve the maximum effect. And I admire him greatly for that. Some of those films are immortal as a result. He was great at it. And that's what he wanted to do. Bob wasn't thinking that way. So the trouble with people who love Altman is they get in a room and they argue about every film because one will love this one and not love that one.
Sure.
So I think that there are people, and I go around the world and meet with people in other countries and talk about films, and I'm always surprised by the general respect but lack of admiration and affection for Bob. And I think it's because Bob is hard to get. Mm. He's hard to get. He's like jazz, you know. He's not a pop song. I think he is a great pop song as well as great jazz. But for people outside of America, I think he's like jazz. He's hard to get.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll see what comes up on the next poll. Maybe we can get, I don't know, The Long Goodbye to sneak in there.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Well, I would say the next contender, well, The Player is a contender,
The Player,
but McCabe
and
Mrs.
Miller. Come on. Okay. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what's your favorite Altman film? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com, or you can leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you'd like additional commentary about Keith Carradine's wardrobe in the final scene of Nashville, you should probably come follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. I have thoughts on the matter. But before you do all of that, please, please go to iTunes, rate us, leave us a nice comment, and tell the folks at Apple what a good job we're doing. Do this, and I will love you forever. 'Cause I'm easy. Huh? Right? I had to. Okay. Pat, it's been a pleasure having you on the show again.
Anytime, Pauline.
All right. Excellent. And just really quickly, one final plug. The Altman biography is called Robert Altman... Jumping
off the cliff.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Until next time, shall we go sit in a traffic jam?
Yes.
All right. Done.
Yeah, I'm easy. Give the word, I'll play your game. So that's how it ought to be. 'Cause I'm easy.